meeting to order. This is the meeting of the District School Board of Indian River County School Board Workshop. The time is 1 p.m. on September 13th, 2016. The purpose of this meeting is for school board members to discuss matters for future policymaking and to share information between the superintendent and staff. Having called the meeting to order, I guess we'll go down the list and see what items there are. As Mr. McCain and Chair Simchek are absent today, next on the list is me. I do not have any matters. At any rate, I would go last. However, up next is Ms. Menes. Ms. Menes, do you have anything?
Yes, thank you. I actually have a couple of questions following up on the workshop on October. I'm sorry. Whoa! I'm going into the future. Yes, I'm advanced. From the 23rd of last month. So I just wanted to follow up regarding the data we received about compliance with the DSEG order in terms of percentages. And my question was whether there were consequences to the school district for being over in percentages relative to the students and to the teachers. And the second question is with regard to requesting data of the charter schools, because as board members know, we are in litigation with them with the expectation that as public schools, they get capital outlay money. And as such, it is surprising that when it comes to compliance on issues of civil rights and desegregation, there's the expectation of exception that as public schools, traditional public schools, they are not beholden to the DSEG order. So those are two items that from the workshop were not clear that I believe we should, as a board, get clarity on. So I just wanted to bring that forward.
Dr. Young.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we responded to the first question about over-representation in membership, for example. If one of the schools has a higher percentage of African-American students than what is required by the desegregation order, there is no penalty that we've been assessed by the court or by anybody. In most of those situations, there's been a conversation with the plaintiff, so to speak, the leadership of the NAACP, and in most of those cases, they have understood why there might be an over-representation in that school, and they don't necessarily have a problem with it or an issue with it. So for over-representation of student membership and over-representation of faculty, there has not been any penalty that I'm aware of. Mr. Gress, anything to add?
No, sir, that is accurate. There was no specific penalty or sanction, if you would, outlined in the desegregation order. These were items for the school board to work towards.
Okay, thank you. In response to the question about charter school data being included in there, if you recall, we were directed by Board Corporate to communicate with the charters on their membership status and a response back from them as to what their plan was to address it if they were below the ratio. We did receive all that information. Mr. Green did tabulate all that. I will go back and see if we did not share that with the board, and I'll make sure to get a copy as soon as possible. But we did engage in that work last spring, late spring, early summer. So we do have data that regards to that. As we move forward, we're going to be monitoring that data, all 27 schools, not just the 22 traditional schools. So we'll be including that in the equity report in the future and that kind of thing.
Okay. And as a follow-up, if I may, Mr. Vice Chair.
So the other layer of this, of course, is what the state's expectation is. And we've seen with the lawsuit that was brought before the state about testing how the courts differ with the Department of Education in terms of how they view the testing opt-out situation. I see a similar situation here where we can collect all the data we want, but do we have clarity from the state in terms of the accountability that we may have to make sure that the charter schools are in compliance, especially as we work with, you know, our Chicago law firm to move forward on the issues relative to the DSEG order? So is there a way of getting, you know, something maybe in writing from the state in terms of what the compliance expectations are?
Absolutely. We understand that the Department of Education is aware throughout the state that charter schools have perhaps not been providing data with regard to the equity report, And Mr. Green had actually been in contact with the Department of Education on that to find out ways to incorporate their data into that equity report. And Mr. Green reported at the next statewide charter school meeting, where there will be both districts and charter schools present, the Department of Education is supposed to give a presentation to charter schools and to districts to explain the data that's required to be reported, that charter schools are required to include that data so that districts can include it in their equity report. So that work is ongoing. I don't believe there's anything in writing, but we're hopeful that that training will produce some sort of a guidance document that may be helpful for the future, but that work is ongoing with the state.
Okay, I'm sorry, but that still doesn't answer my question. That's relative to data.
Okay.
Beyond data collection, what is the expectation relative to compliance? Because we can get all the data we want, but if the charter schools feel that because they are charter schools, they do not have to comply with DSEG order, as we see reflected in some of the demographics of current charter schools, not that they've decided to willfully do that, but the numbers tell the story. We don't have to discuss it. Is the state going to articulate that there is an expectation beyond data collection that in the same way we're held to our DSEG order, the charter schools as public schools are also expected to comply? Because I think that's a fuzzy area where there doesn't seem to be any guidance unless, you know, that has been provided and I haven't been privy to it.
I'm not sure how the state will respond to that query.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I am aware of is federal desegregation requirements are under federal law,
mm-hmm.
and all charter schools are required to comply with federal law, period.
Mm-hmm.
So the process that we may have to use, I'm not sure I can define for you if we are looking to enforce compliance, but federal laws apply evenly to all public schools, whether you are charter or not in the state of Florida.
Okay. Thank you.
Is that it?
Yep.
Mr. Sushi?
I have a couple of items. I'd like for the superintendent or Carter or somebody to give me the idea or the plan for eliminating the need for tax anticipation note financing.
Thank you, Mr. Searcy. We've discussed a little bit at the budget workshops throughout the year about the funding timeline that we receive our various funds from the state. And, you know, the need for a TAN is somewhat a symptom of the timeline of when we receive those funds. I'll have Mr. Morrison explain it in more detail. So that's one of the reasons that sometimes districts find themselves in the place where they need to issue a TAN. And there was another large district that just issued their TAN recently. Mr. Morrison may talk about that. The past couple of years, to try to boil it down into some simple terms, in the past couple of years, we have not needed to issue a TAN. This year, there were several factors that kind of came together that caused us to feel like we needed the TAN to make sure that we'll be fiscally solvent. Number one, we are directing a good amount of funds towards the insurance deficit, the health insurance deficit. We have to start paying that back, and the safe harbor. Two, if you recall, we will receive a little bit less funding up front this year because of reporting errors and recalibration with FTE last fall. Because remember, we're funded based on last fall's numbers, and we saw some errors in that. And then also, in general, we did not receive a very large increase in funding from the state overall. Our budget this year was basically flat with a small percent increase. So I think those three factors combined put us in a position to have to issue a TAN this year. As we've talked at the budget workshop the last couple of years, we didn't. But previously we have. And most districts that, as Mr. Morrison explained in one of the workshops, that rely a lot on property tax revenue for their funding stream, issue the TANs. So I'm going to let Mr. Morrison go into a little bit more detail.
Thank you, Dr. Rendell. I think you've hit the main highlights. Just to kind of give you a scope, because of the reporting errors that we had last year, we are underfunded for about 283 students, FTE, as compared to last year. You multiply that by the total funds per student of $7,273.77, That's an underfunding of over $2 million. Mm-hmm. So that has impacted, obviously, our cash coming in. We've talked about a potential fix in terms of, I'm not sure if it's legislative or a Department of Education procedure, where in the past they would advance fund you your FEFP for 3 months. So that took care of the period leading up to when you collect your taxes. So that could be a potential fix. There's something also that I think is very important for us to kind of take up a broader view, is the state's policy on funding the FEFP. And what we've seen, particularly last year, is that the state is trying to substitute, if you will, local property revenues for more state funding. However, looking through some of the, and I do have some a handout to give you to some of the emails that we got, looking at the funding situation from an economic perspective, it would appear as if the state will have less money to work with as we go forward in the future. I just highlighted some areas there for you. In short, given the essential spending projections matched against revenues, the estimate, the risk of the revenue estimating conference shows a potential net increase of $7.5 million for 17-18 and a shortfall of over $1 billion in starting in FY19. And there is some conversation about, you know, the cuts that the governor has made. They're kind of coming home to roost, if you will. So there are some policy decisions that also affect whether or not at the local level we're able to fund the FEFP, fund our operations. It's very simple. You either raise your revenue or you cut your expenditures. As you've seen at the last TRIM hearing, you have not very little control over the millage rate, which would allow you to raise more revenue. So that's not really an avenue for you to go. On the expense side, 67% of your budget, roughly, is for salaries and benefits. If it were the direction for board corporate to direct the superintendent and staff to try to build up our liquidity reserves, then that would be the only place, I believe, that we would have to look at cuts in order to build up your cash reserves.
You're saying that's general fund budget, not overall budget. Okay,
general.
Thank you.
So the plan for the future is kind of dark right now.
So what Mr. Morrison was talking about, he started to look at solutions. So the advanced funding of the FEFP is something that will be taken to the state legislature and the DOE as a request, not just us. There's several other districts across the state that are going to bring that forward in the coming months, because if they would advance fund the FEFP or give us the opportunity to advance fund the FEFP, that should be, I can't guarantee, but that should be enough funds that we wouldn't have to issue a TAN in a normal budget year, so to speak. Also, the solution is, you know, like Mr. Morrison said, we either increase our revenue or decrease spending or both. Well, we don't really have a lot of avenues to increase our revenue. So as we prepare the budget for 17-18, you know, we're going to try to make sure that we're as lean as possible. And what he was hinting at is if you wanted to make sure that we had enough money set aside in reserves that we wouldn't have to issue a TAN, then we'd probably have to look at cutting staff, because such a large percentage of our budget is staff. And so, you know, that's plain talk about, you know, how we would, what we would have to do probably to set aside those reserves to carry us through that time.
Now, in this thing that gentleman presented the other day, it showed that we're only down like $1.5 million or $2 million, but during October up to November 15th. But we have a budget. It's $268 million, something like that, this year. And sometime we're going to get our $268 million from the state and from the federal and from the local taxes, and we're going to have that much money. And you put the budget together for us to have $268 million to spend. And so I don't understand if we say it's the fault of the real estate taxes not coming in a timely manner or whatever you want to put that. It doesn't make sense, because we're still going to get the $268 million. We just haven't spent it right. Sounds to me like now. Because if it's $268 million and our budget is balanced, we should have access to 268 million.
I believe it's 284. 268 was the year before.
Or 264. Well, a bunch.
Right. So two things to respond to. Number one, I did ask Mr. Morrison to go look at Mr. Airwater's numbers and that kind of thing so he can respond to that. And, again, I think it is, again, a symptom of when we get the lion's share of that funding. So, but I'll let him respond to Mr. Airwater's.
Sure. One, before you move from that one, this is the cash flow. Do we have any cash reserves that we could put in here to make up?
That accounts for all cash in the general fund.
And reserves
in the general fund. So Mr. Atwater, or
whatever his name is,
this is meant, based on the information that you have in front of you, that would be correct. Why in the world would we say we've got a $2 million deficit, conservatively three, and ask you to borrow not to exceed $8.4 million? Why would we do that? Well, if you add the insurance fund deficit to that, then that's why you get to, I think the revised number is about $7.8 million now. So that only accounted for the general operating fund, and in order to do a TAM legally, you have to have that deficit in the general operating fund in order to for you to even go out for a TAM. So that's the difference between what we're asking the board not to exceed versus what was presented in that memo.
But then the transfer for the insurance doesn't come until
we delayed that. We delayed that on purpose. So
you don't need that during those October, November, and December, which is
we are burning through cash as we speak. However, the transfer we try to shove it off to the end so we don't create a larger deficit in the interim.
So, since we're on this, are we gonna still go ahead and borrow the $8 million bucks? Or
actually, we are. I'm actually preparing a memorandum to clarify all of that. The bids have been received. Tomorrow, my staff and I will be on a conference call with Ford and Associates to review the bids that have come in, so we can make a recommendation to the school board at the next, I believe, it's September 27th meeting.
And you have to have the money in hand or the loan by September 30th, correct?
Right around.
I think that's what you said.
Just to follow up on a few things that Dr. Rendell mentioned, Palm Beach County, they just issued $115 million in tax anticipation note proceeds to stem their temporary cash flow deficit as well. So that's pretty significant, but obviously for their size, they would do something like that.
But we're not in Palm Beach.
No, we're not.
In the river, and we got you.
But I think one of the things I want the board to understand and the public, anybody listening or watching or whatever, is that as we prepare the budget for next year, this is going to be part of our discussion, is how do we try to avoid putting ourselves in the position that we have to issue a TAN. So it's not like we're just going to say, you know what, we have this funding cycle. It's a unfortunate thing that we have this funding cycle, so we're just going to plan on having a TAN because we can. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, But, no, as we prepare the budget and we have the budget workshops and that kind of thing, we'll have that discussion about what are we doing to try to eliminate the need for that.
And I guess another piece of this gentleman's presentation was that why would we have the money outstanding for so long? Is that going to be addressed?
That's a very good question. Yes, I'll address it in the memorandum. But in short, when we count our students in October, we pretty much don't get our adjustment from the state until everybody gets back in January. So that creates a time lag between those two points. So that's the reason why we're recommending a short duration. Most school districts actually have it outstanding until June 30th. I'm very one of the few, if not the only one, who shortens the duration on those notes.
So just to be clear, because people will be listening to this, what we're left with as a result of the size and timing of the cash flows from the state being delayed from August through November are two fairly unpalatable options of either A, building up the cash reserve, essentially borrowing money from the taxpayers and building up a nest egg, or B, issuing a TAN and incurring transaction costs.
Right. And those two are the options. However, as I've mentioned, both have disadvantages. We talked about taxing and sitting. You know, that's not something you necessarily want to do. But if it is the direction of the board corporate, and Dr. Rendell mentioned it, we can start working on our budget now with a view to making sure that we are trying to build up our liquidity to a point where we don't necessarily want to be doing this. What is unique about this year, as we mentioned, the underfunding of the FTE, that really is a big number, as well as just the cyclical nature of the cash flows from the state and the taxpayers. Yes.
Yeah, and I think that's an important discussion, because right now we did have the referendum approved for the 0.6, and if we're thinking of taxing and sitting, I'm sorry, for the 0.5, but if we're thinking of taxing and sitting, that's going to be another issue for the taxpayers when this TAN, now that we have all the information, not just one little piece of information that was presented to the board at the last meeting, now that we have a comprehensive understanding of the different factors, I think it's important for the community to also consider, you know, what is a realistic option? Do they want the board to tax and sit, or do they want the board to cut positions that are going to impact learning and students in the school district? One question that I do have, when I watched the video of that workshop, I was disappointed that the data that was used was for a different district. And I wanted to understand why we didn't just use our data, since we were talking about Indian River County, because it was about us. So if you could give me some insight into that.
I believe Mr. Ford made the comment that this is pretty much the cyclical nature that all school districts experience, where you start off in July with a relatively high fund balance, and as you start your operations, and particularly in August when school opens up and teachers are hired and staff is on board, you start burning down that fund balance and your liquidity. And then you'll see that dip, and you experience a temporary deficit until you get your tax monies. If you were to graph out the state revenues, you'd probably see more of a straight line. But that's a constant, because they essentially take your revenue and divide it by 12 months, and then they give you a steady stream of payments, which you do get an adjustment based on the October count. But if you were to graph the cycle for local revenues, then you would see that dip. You'd have no money collected, actually, from July until right around November, when the tax notices are finalized and sent out. Then you see a big spike.
And that's my question. I understand the concept, and I think that it would have been more helpful to use our district data and see our district dip versus making that analogy, which for a particular situation where you're trying to educate the board, we would have benefited from looking at our own numbers, because we understand the general, because we've talked about it before.
It would have essentially just taking those numbers off the chart there and just doing a graph to show that.
No, I understand, but I think, you know, looking forward, that might be helpful. Thank you.
Would there be, how big of an impact was this, a couple of deals that we did this last year where we paid retroactive pay? I don't think that you would have budgeted those numbers in our budget last year to anticipate the fact that we're, and that's the largest part of our budget, that we were going to be paying a year or 2 years worth of salaries back during this year, because we didn't have the contracts negotiated finalized for years.
I believe last year's contract was settled in time for the fiscal year. It was a kind of a rush at the end for CWA.
Right. The IRCA, which is the largest monetary group, was settled in time for the budget cycle.
Correct.
But it was CWA.
CWA was done at the end of the year, and as you may recall, we put into the budget the recurring cost of that raise, the 2.5% for this year. So that's a recurring cost. However,
we paid it last year.
We paid it last year, but we know that the rates are higher for this year. But don't forget that there's also retirements, people leave, and so there's a lot of personnel movement, which creates sometimes a salary lapse, sometimes it doesn't, depending upon who's in, who's out, that kind of thing. So it's not an exact science, but it does create some savings and leveling off, if you will, of some of the budgetary numbers.
Well, I seem to recall that one of the groups that received retroactive pay were the administrators and non-representative, that's not represented by unions. Is that Am I recalling correctly?
We had several different
ones. Was that restoration?
No, it was retroactive. Well, not only the leveling, but also there were some increases that went retroactive.
There was some salary adjustments based on the salary study that we did last year. And I believe anyone who did not receive an increase, percentage increase, the number doesn't...
A flat amount.
Okay, that's correct.
But it wasn't budgeted.
It was budgeted. It came from the fund balance, yes, sir.
How do you know a year in advance what we're going to negotiate?
We don't.
That's his job, to just
it's an estimate.
Eyeball.
It's an estimate.
Crystal ball.
No. Well, I would guess that it informs our negotiating strategy.
Yes, it informs. Absolutely.
That's maybe the way to put that, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair. Wow. Okay, we don't really have a good plan for next year then. Okay, we can...
We don't have a plan per se written down. I think that the idea is that we don't have a lot of control over increasing our incoming revenue. But one thing we can do is talk with the legislature and the state DOE about flex funding, advance funding the FEFP, which would be one solution. But the other solution is, as we build the budget for next year, as we start to say, you know, how can we be even leaner to build up a fund balance, if that's, you know, as we go through that process, the board will be involved in setting that direction. So,
Ms. Menes?
Yes, thank you. I just have a clarification question for an item that's on tonight's agenda, which is the testing calendar. It's my understanding that there will be no fair testing this year, and so I was just curious as to why the fair testing and the time allotments are on the calendar that is coming before us for approval.
I believe, and Mr. Green can answer this in more detail tonight, because I don't think he's here, I believe we have to list all state assessments, whether we use them or not.
Ah, okay. And then just as another clarification, is the when you talk about the EMS Web Tier 1 and Tier 2, are those MTSS tiers? Or
correct.
Are they, okay.
And
perfect.
So it's the opposite of performance level. It's
okay.
Level 1, 2.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
Smith. Good questions.
Well, on that issue, we have to submit that, and it may come up tonight, but we have to submit that list of all testing, and all we do is take their form and fill in some blanks. Is that just minutiae that we just have to do? Or, I mean,
no,
is it,
not necessarily.
Does it mean anything?
No, sir, because it does inform our work. You know, we have to set the testing windows. We have to fall in line with the calendar and that kind of thing. So the fact that it's a form now that we fill in means that, you know, the state's going to get a uniform testing calendar from every district, so to speak. They're going to get the same data in the same format from every district, so they can kind of see what everybody across the district, across the state, is doing, whereas before they were getting different looking spreadsheets from all of us. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it's a form that we fill out probably helps them tabulate the data, but, you know, we would be doing this without the form.
And just historically, there was a tremendous outrage a few years ago about the amount of testing that was happening in the schools, and this was the state's response to try to get it under control. So they started saying, you guys have to let us know, because what happened was everybody was blaming everybody else. If you talk to the school district, they're like, well, no, it's the state. If you talk to the state, well, no, it's the local. And so that was a way of saying, okay, people, be transparent. And if you notice, it tells you what's local, what's state, what's federal. So historically, it's also to a response to parents' concerns and people speaking up about this issue, because at the time, the Secretary of Education, who had to finally leave, did not handle that situation very well. So a little historical perspective is also helpful.
Looks to me like it'd be a lot easier for everybody, the state and all the folks that are pushing the papers, if we just had every student take a test when they go in, and every student take a test when they go out of every class, and we'll find out what they did, and parents would be happy, and students would be happy, and
not to disagree necessarily, but if we don't test them again till the end, it's kind of like that's the autopsy, that's at the end, you know. So the tests during the year are kind of progress monitoring, just to make sure they're progressing. So not a lot, but, you know, some benchmark tests along the way just to make sure they're progressing.
And the district keeps that under the state mandate 5%, as we saw in the memorandum.
Just a thought. I mean,
yes, ma'am.
Why did we stop? Why is fair testing stopped now?
Because we're using a different way to assess their progress, using the iReady software and some other other tests that we think are more accurate, more reliable, and more quick and easy to administer. The FAIR test was lengthy and didn't provide us with very valuable data.
Better formative testing.
Yep.
Yes, ma'am.
And I think, you know, I usually vote against this item because I am just so appalled at the amount of testing. And even though I understand that it's not an autopsy, that you really need to be doing formative assessment before you do the summative, if you get online and you look at the documentation for the board meeting, it's 3 pages long. We're not saying we're doing a pretest, maybe 2 in the middle, and a post-test. It's for reading. It's for math. And you know, and it's like, how do we find that balance? One of the things that I'd be curious to see that I don't think we as a board have ever asked for is, what does it cost us? What is it costing us for compliance to state, compliance to federal, and all of the local testing that we do? I'm glad to see that SAT-10, which ended up not being as useful as we were led to believe that we paid for every time, has gone away. But, you know, do we really look at all that testing and consider, is that really the amount that we need to be doing, especially at the local level? Because my understanding is that a lot of this is driven because the teacher evaluation is dependent on student progress. So even though on the assessment calendar where it says it's optional, a lot of people whose raise or whatever, whose improvement bonus is contingent on this, are not going to say, oh, that's optional, you know, we're not going to overtest the kids. It's like, I want to know where they are because I want them to do well. And so how do you balance that? Because some of that testing, I still believe, is superfluous. There is so much. And I would just welcome, you know, community members to look at that because it is a very extensive list. And, you know, it's hard. I mean, we have to comply. But I also feel that our job as school board members is to ask these questions and see if we can't do better advocacy and find ways of reducing the testing, even though we're within that 5%.
Sure.
Which is, you know, that's 5%.
It should have been 3%.
Right. So, you know, so that's just for consideration, you know, for the board to keep in mind moving forward.
Well, I'll ask the question here rather than tonight. Are we still testing 4s and 5s for all these benchmarks? I mean, because that is one area where I think we could be doing, like, enrichment activities with that. And I know that, oh, it makes it hard to teach or whatever. Well, you know, sometimes doing the right thing is difficult. So are we still testing every 4 and 5 at every benchmark?
It's subject-specific. Some of the subjects, they are being tested because it's subject-specific.
Okay.
So like an EOC 4s or something like that. So civics, you know, American history, stuff like that.
Right.
Reading and in general math, I'd have to defer to Ms. Tampier or Mr. Green. But, you know, with even when we were issuing the FAIR, that wasn't being administered to the 4s and 5s. So I don't think if we're using iReady, that we'd be issuing that to the 4s and 5s. But I can get an answer and get back to you guys.
I just think that's an opportunity where we can reduce some of the testing and improve education. Seriously?
No, I agree with you on that. That's, I watch my 4-year-old grandson, and I'm wondering how well he would do with a computer test. You know, and I'm assuming they're all on the computer because we don't use paper anymore. But it doesn't make sense to me to be testing 4 and 5-year-old kids. I'm sorry, students. That kid slipped out.
Got it.
How much do we spend on that testing on 4 and 5-year-old?
Is there any interest in like as the board?
I think Mr. Frost was talking about the level 4s and 5s.
Correct.
Not FSA.
Not
4 and 5
year olds. I'm sorry.
No, I was actually referring to students who had scored a 4 or a 5 on the previous year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Basically saying, you know, do we really need a progress monitor, mm-hmm. or let's just say just 5s? Because I think that's, you know, I mean, I know we want to keep them in the 5 and all that so that we get the max points and everything, but there's a point where you just fatigue a student, especially a student who's identified as gifted, by just continually testing them, and they, you know, I think eventually they're going to put up a bad result. But I just think that there's better use of time with those students, you know, through customized learning or things like that.
Yeah, and you know, and I think a couple of things. Number one, when you're talking about gifted students, just because a student is gifted doesn't mean they're gifted in every single subject
True.
Area.
Absolutely.
So that's something to take into account. Relative to Board Member Searcy's comment, I do think that when we're looking at our younger kids, that there is something to be said, even though, you know, toddlers now are walking around playing with
right.
iPads.
Grab a
magazine. I understand that. But, you know, I have heard since I've been on the board and we've started doing this computer-based testing of our younger students, how sometimes that is just not appropriate for them. The keyboard skills, and even if it's not keyboard, they're still, you know, too young. And I don't know if anybody's actually looked to see the impact. But I know that last year I did speak to someone that monitored some of this and shared with me the frustration that some of the students were feeling. So I'm thinking if this is an assessment that is that important and students are stressed out, I don't think that's a good thing. And that doesn't help them to be successful. So that's something that, you know, is worth looking into. And lastly, you know, I don't know if the board is interested in getting a sense of how much we spend on all this testing at the different levels, because that's something that we might want to ask about and maybe set some parameters. Because when you say, you know, how much is it costing us, are we going to ask staff to say, okay, how much of a teacher's time, what percentage, how much money, or are we looking at more general parameters relative to testing? So, you know, that's something to consider.
Well, there's actually a white paper that was done by one of our colleagues in Collier County and some statistician, and they looked at the opportunity cost mm-hmm. of all the testing we're doing, and it was significant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'll be happy to share that with the board. But I think that may be an excellent idea for our audit committee once established to take on. To look at, you know, the cost of testing and the way we do business as far as operational.
So somebody take note.
Take note. I think that's
the thing is just taking note right now.
So make a note.
Audience.
Yes.
I think when you go into that, you also need to probably look at the fact the state mandates a lot more local testing. Mm-hmm. What is the cost that the state is mandating? And break it out into how much are we actually costing our own district by the amount of testing that we do. Because if the state is mandating testing locally, we need to go back to the state and say these are unfunded mandates also.
That's a good point.
One thing Ms. Jimenez indicated about these young kids being able to play on the little machines, but they don't use keyboards. And when they do the test, they use the keyboards, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I already made a note that what we're going to do at the next board shop is show you guys some of the kindergarten assessments so you can see what they look like and how they're administered and that kind of thing, so we know what the kindergartners and first graders are facing.
You don't like give us the test.
That's what I was going to say. I
think it would be a demonstration.
That's anxiety.
I've heard the thing about the fifth grade.
Are you smarter than the kindergartner?
We can do up to three, sure.
Okay.
All right, thank
Mr. Searcy, your next item?
Yep. The sort of follow-up on the first one there, what's our plan to not have to go back to the voters, taxpayers, for another critical operating needs tax referendum? When we went for the $6 million, I have some folks have told me that we promised that it would not happen again. And we just went back to the taxpayers for this $5 million thing, and we told them again it's not going to happen again. So what's our plan to make sure that this doesn't become a permanent tax?
Well, first of all, I never said to anybody we won't do this again in 4 years. I think I said we would try our best not to be in this position again in 4 years. I think that's the most I said it on that at any time. Really, it's going to be a matter of as we approach the next 4 years, how do we budget? How do we take a look at the costs that are being funded from the 0.5, and how can we somehow roll that into our operating budget in the future? One of the things that I think is a little tricky is, for example, if we look at the teaching positions that are funded by the now is 0.5 millage, if we were to roll them into the budget in 2 years, then the money that's generated from the 0.5 what would we do with those funds? If we were to spend them somewhere else, then we would have, you know, violated the agreement that we had with, you know, the taxpayer. So the idea is, as we look towards a longer term, especially the years 2, 3, and 4, we need to say, all right, this millage is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. How can we roll those costs into our budget, operating budget in the future, so we don't have to go ask the voters for more money? You know, that was one of the things I did say on the radio. Someone said, "Oh, you, congratulations! You know, your referendum passed." I said, "Well, it's not really a victory anytime we're asking people to spend more money. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a victory when we have to ask people to spend more in taxes. So even though we were thankful and grateful for the support of the community, it's not a victory." Mm-hmm. So the idea would be, just in budgeting process over the next 3 to 4 years, we start to figure out how can we absorb those costs. You know, hopefully, you know, the budget, well, the state's budget would improve as the economy improves, so we could get to the point where we're not needing those funds to come from the community. They're already coming from the general revenue that we get from the state. But like Mr. Morrison said, the forecast for next year is already less bright than this year. So, you know, it's going to be a thin, lean budget next year.
Part of this board has been there before.
Yep.
Part of us have not, whenever they had to make the major cuts. But it's amazing to me that when you had to make those major cuts, you made it work. You made it work.
Well, it's so, my understanding of the history is that we made it work till we got to 11 and 12, and we couldn't really cut any more, and that's when we said we need some help from the community and asked for the 0.6. And the budget hasn't grown back to that point yet. You know, we're still operating at a 68% budget of what we were at in 2007. So we're still delivering the same services to about the same amount of students on a 68% budget of what we had in 2007. So I guess the idea would be, if we ever get back to 100% of what we were at 2007, theoretically, not factoring the cost of living and all those other things, we shouldn't need the additional funding. So I think it's, again, there's no plan. I can't tell you there's a plan, but I think the idea would be, as we go forward in the next 2, 3, 4 years, as we say, this is not a recurring revenue source, because we do have to ask for the approval every time, and so it would be good to say, you know what, let's see what we can do to try to roll those funds, those expenditures into our budget. I can't promise that, and I can't. There's no concrete plan.
But to see the plan.
So, that's, absolutely.
That's there's a plan to make a plan.
That's what's important to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and I think that this is an important conversation for the board, because what I think what you're going to find is, when you combine this desire to eliminate the TAN and the implications for the budget on that, and then on top of it, you're thinking about how you're going to include the this critical operating needs, these positions, into the budget, you're going to be juggling a lot of different things. And I think one of the things that gets lost, and that I've noticed, you know, when I started on the board, is that we get so caught up in the numbers and in saying, you know, we want to cut here, we want to cut there, we forget that we're dealing with the whole child, that we're dealing with students, and that some of the support positions that are in place benefit students. Because a lot of times it's like, let's just focus on teachers, let's just focus on programs, everything else is extraneous. And there are a lot of things that are not extraneous, because it's the whole package that helps the students move forward. And I hope that that's something that board members keep in mind, you know, moving forward, because when I've been here, we've just been trying to cut, and we see the consequences of not supporting our programs and supporting our teachers the way that they should be supported, because our budget is really representative of our aspirations for our students. And it's not just about the money itself and doing everything on the cheap. It's about serving our students with excellence. And that gets lost in these conversations, because we're fearful of a lot of these financial issues, which rightfully so, but let's not forget that. And, you know, I repeat it, I won't be on the board then, but I do hope you all remember that, because sometimes we forgot that, and it did not help our students or teachers. And in the end, we had to come back and refund as best as we could. So.
Thank you. Yes?
Just a quick question. So the millage was for teachers, technology, and training. So my question would be, I guess for Mr. Searcy, what I've been in the community and what I've heard is requests from the community for more vocational education or career technical education. And that's what part of this millage is going to cover. So I guess my question would be, when the community wants a service that the school district can't provide within its budget, do you think it's fair for the community to ask, for the school district to ask the community, we would like to do this too, this is what the cost would be, if this is something you're interested in, could you vote for it please to allow us to provide that service to our students?
That's very possible to do, and it's very possible to go out and ask for a tax increase, not just the millage increase, but we need to have those items in our operational budget. We get money from the state for the vocational programs. We get it in arrears, I guess you would call it, but after we get certification, we get a big flood of money, and we can use that money to start up the new programs, I guess, if we budget accordingly. But you know, if we go to the public for funding like this for education, they're going to vote for it. I mean, it's a given. They're going to vote for it. I don't know of any bond referendum that I've ever heard of in this county that got presented to the taxpayers that they voted down.
So what does that mean?
That means there may be a better way to do it. We need to put these items in the operational budget instead of in these short-term loans like this. We need
to
have.
The public is willing. 65% of the public is willing to support the school system. Those schools really can't do it alone, and they need the support. What does that tell us about our community's support of our schools? That's just my question.
Just a follow-up question. Because part of the millage that we are getting is going to be used for vocational programs, I think we would be remiss if we did not ask clarification. Do we get a big flood of money for career and technical education? And if so, why did we put that on the millage? Because that could be confusing to community members.
I wouldn't characterize it as a big flood of money. Right. The state supports career and professional education, acronym is CAPE, and we receive a fractional FTE dependent upon what course is being taken from the state. It may range from a 0.16 to maybe a 0.23 or something like that. So it's not a lot of money. However, we try the best that we can to support our programs that are particularly at the high school level. Dr. Endel can speak to more of the community resources.
So, on that, what Mr. Searcy was referring to was after students earn certification.
Right.
In most of these career and technical courses, there are certifications that the students can earn. When they earn those certifications, then the state does give us money for that. They direct funds back to us based on the number of students who pass those certifications. It seems like a lot of money. You know, it's $100,000 or so. It's in the hundreds of thousands or whatever. But when you're trying to put in a new technical program, you're talking more like in the high hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. So the equipment that's necessary to put in new programs often far exceeds the amount of money you would get on a return from your CAPE certification dollars. So it is really kind of seed money to get those programs started, also to upgrade the equipment in some of our existing programs and that kind of thing. The good news is this is for the 17-18 budget, so we'll be able to bring you all kinds of, you know, reports showing what the money is going to be used for, what the funding will be used for, and that kind of thing. And you can see it'll be a good accounting of the dollars, and it'll be in response to what the community is telling us they need. Which, you know, I had a conversation just last night with a group of folks. Our Technical Center for Career and Adult Education, the TCCA, our Adult Ed Center, is undergoing its review right now as we speak. There's an accreditation group there reviewing their operations to make sure they're doing everything they're supposed to be doing. And so the people are there from an outside organization to review them and make sure that we're delivering the, you know, high-quality education we're supposed to our adult population, not just our K-12 population. But most of the talk in the room yesterday was about the fact that the pendulum is swinging back towards everybody understanding not every one of our students needs to go to a four-year university to have a good career after high school. So the idea is we need to make sure that we're providing all the programs that we can in our comprehensive high schools and other programs so that they can walk out of here with a certification that will lead right to employment, and usually in an actually fairly high-paying sector. So we're just kind of right in line with the national movement, again, back towards a concentration on career and technical or vocational education. So it's what we're seeing a lot in the local community as well. So I just think that... So in 4 years, would we need those funds? I don't know. you know, but if we've built up our programs and everything seems to be moving along pretty well, maybe we wouldn't need those funds. If we did need those funds but we didn't need the others, you know, then we would, you know, we could look at different funding mechanisms for that type of need. But I think, you know, Mr. Frost kind of summed it up. There's a plan to work on the plan.
And my understanding is that, in broad strokes, the legislature, from a budgeting standpoint, has been very interested in funding these over the last few sessions.
Florida is actually one of the few states that support the career and professional education with a portion of an FTE on funding.
Okay.
So do you know what the outlook is for that?
That's good.
Well, given the outlook,
the technical education.
Was technical. Just from a budget perspective, if you're working with $1 billion less, then priorities, choices have to be made. But we typically wait until the session starts, and then we kind of see where things go from there.
My understanding from a priority aspect, it's high with leadership. So
it's high.
Vocational or technical career funding is a high priority. And another thing that we haven't really touched on is there are actually bonuses for the teachers.
Correct.
That come in once they pass the certifications as well for the students. So it's true performance pay.
Mm-hmm.
So once they pass the cert, the teachers get a nice bonus check. Okay. Ms. Mendes, did you have anything?
That was it.
Ms. Searcy, next item.
I had a parent contact me the other night about this accelerated reading program, and apparently it's going away in some of the schools. And the question would be why? Apparently, it's are we trying to get all of our students level 3 or whatever? Because I guess the accelerated reading program. Allows each one of the students to be able to read on their own level, and some are level 5 and some are 1 to replace Mr. Vice Chairman's numbers there from a minute ago. What's the status on it? Why are we getting rid of it? Whose idea was it?
So we'll start with a little bit of history. The Accelerated Reader Program is actually more of a reading incentive program. Mm-hmm. Students read books. They're on a list. If there's a quiz associated with that book on the list, and they take that quiz, get a certain number of points for that. In most schools across the country that use accelerated reading, it's really an incentive contest. You win prizes and that kind of thing. It's not meant to be an instructional tool, more like a reading incentive program. Last spring, when the departments were asked to do zero-based budgeting, to go through everything they're spending money on, mm-hmm. and to see whether it was worthwhile, the Accelerated Reader Program was actually in Mr. Green's budget because it was a software program, so it was being paid for out of the IT budget. But it's a curriculum issue, so he went to curriculum and said, you know, these 7 or 8 curricular programs that are being funded out of my budget because they're actually technology-based or web-based or whatever, mm-hmm. which of these are most important, which ones could we cut, and that kind of thing. So we had Accelerated Reader at the elementary and secondary level. At the secondary level, it was not really being used that much. So they took basically a cost-benefit analysis and said at the elementary level, it seems to be used quite a bit, mm-hmm. and mostly for the purpose it's supposed to be used for, which is incentives. Mm-hmm. At the secondary level, it wasn't used across the board at most of the schools. Some of the schools were using it, but to cut it at the secondary level would save us $60,000. So the decision was made that, you know, it's not a high-use program in the secondary schools. The schools that were using it, some of them were still using it for a grading component, which they weren't supposed to be. In fact, in 2014, you know, the schools were issued a directive, I think, either from Dr. Adams or Mrs. Long at the time, but Dr. Long through secondary programs, to make sure that we're not supposed to be using Accelerated Reader as a grading component, mm-hmm. use it as an incentive. So that's kind of the background. It's not a instructional strategy program like Read 180 or some of the other programs that we've used. It's really an incentive-based program. The older kids sometimes game the system. There's a set number of questions, 10 multiple-choice questions, and they talk to each other, you know, hey, you took the quiz on Catcher in the Rye. What did you, you know, what are the questions? So that's one of the reasons we didn't want to use it for grading purposes, because the kids can game the system. So it's really supposed to be a reading incentive program. One of the middle schools is still looking at purchasing it. for that middle school, they've been able to negotiate, I believe, a reduced rate of about $3,800, I think is what they're looking at. So for the 10 secondary schools that we were looking at, or the six secondary schools, rather, that we were, you know, the $60,000 figure, that was $10,000 per school. So right now, one of the middle schools is looking at actually purchasing it. If they fundraise for it or something like that, it's going to be, I think, $3,800.
So they can do it out of their own budget.
Yes, sir, they can.
So the vendor was willing to charge us $10,000 for license.
Correct.
But they, you know, by breaking the license and going back to market and bidding it out, it's now $3,800.
I'm not 100% sure of that. That's the figure I was quoted. But so, long story short, it's not an actual teaching strategy.
Okay.
It's supposed to be a reading incentive program. Very appropriate for elementary grades, not so appropriate for secondary necessarily. Sixth, seventh, eighth grade, I guess you could rely on it as an incentive program. But again, I wouldn't use it for grades.
Okay. Answer the question.
And I just think, you know, this is a perfect example for the community for what happens when you do zero-based budgeting and when you're trying to be mindful of expenses and you prioritize what is important for students and what is not. And I think, you know, moving forward, the board can expect to hear a lot more feedback as the school district continues to cull and focus their dollars laser-like on what are the programs that support students. I recall with this program, when my kids, eons ago, were in the schools, the questions on the accelerated reader were not even higher-level thinking questions. It was pure regurgitation of little facts from the story. So it was an incentive to get the students reading, but it, like Dr. Rendell said, it's not an instructional tool. But kids like, you know, like PBS, they like to get little awards and toys and candy and whatnot. And, you know, candy is another issue. I hope we don't do that anymore. But I think it's a great example, zero-based budgeting at its finest, and you're going to get pushback, and you have to be ready for it.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Full disclosure, though, I would like to admit a mistake that we did make. We did not communicate very well with the schools last spring when we made the decision that this was going to be cut from the program. So the secondary schools and the teachers, when they came back this fall, that was a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our fault. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll make sure that that doesn't happen again in the future. But, you know, as a teacher, if I had that as kind of my part of my repertoire and I came back and all of a sudden was told, you don't have that anymore, that's a mistake on our part and I want to own that.
They didn't blame you. They blamed me and Sean. They said, you're new on the board and it's going to be your fault.
Thanks a lot,
I appreciate that.
Okay. Accountability without responsibility.
That's great. That's ideal. That's elected life. Okay, so I think we've gone through all of our scheduled items. One last lap around. Any last burning issues for the district before we move to committee reports?
A couple more questions.
Yes, sir.
Sorry. Do we have an employee handbook for all of our employees?
We don't have an employee handbook per se that I'm aware of, so I'll find out about that.
Would it be beneficial to have one of those? I mean, it would have all the rules and regulations. We have a student handbook, and I would just think, you know, from a business standpoint, it would be really good to know what the rules and regulations are and not just assume. But just a question there. Okay.
Yeah.
Before you move on to the next one, a question. We wouldn't consider the board policies,
right.
The handbook. What additional information do you think is lacking?
I just know that, I don't know whether it's lacking or not, but I just know that in every business I've ever been associated with, there's an employee handbook. It doesn't have to be the school board rules. It just needs to be, you're an employee, you come to work at 8 o'clock and you get off at 3 o'clock. I mean, it's a very simple deal. It tells you how many days of vacation you got. It's kind of a... we just assume that everybody knows all that.
Okay,
but,
cool.
But we my understanding, we don't have an employee handbook. And I just think it would be a good thing to look into if we could get it printed free and, I mean, you know, be in the zero budget or whatever.
Printed free.
Printed free.
Printed by using our internal resources.
We have a print shop.
Okay. Have we done a safety and security audit recently?
It was concluded last May, I believe.
Okay. And we have that, or?
Yeah, but I mean, we can pull it up and make sure everybody gets a copy.
And let's see. There was one other one that I had on my little list here. Did we ever find out what our how much money we spend on the work comp insurance?
I don't have that figure right now. We can find out.
Okay. You know. That's a note I sent to Marion or something.
Oh, that's right. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We'll get that.
Along those lines, I have a question. Are we at a point now where we have a job description for every employee that they've signed and recognized as that being their job and their duties?
I don't think that. I think all full-time employees and part-time employees. That's yes, we do.
Okay.
Supplements. I'll tell you for sure that we don't have a job description for every supplemented position.
Okay.
You know, but for some of the ones that we've been asking about, we've been creating job descriptions for. For example, the multicultural coordinators,
right.
There's a job description in the works for that. But
like coach, assistant,
right.
JV, girls volleyball coach?
Interact club sponsor.
Right.
I don't think there's a job description for that.
Okay.
So
it's difficult to hold people accountable, I would think,
right.
In that environment. Might be worth the time to invest in those in the best we can.
Well, in St. Lucie County, when I was in HR in St. Lucie County, we had a general supplement handbook.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So there were some general terms. If you're receiving a supplement from the school district of performance service, these are some non-negotiable mm-hmm. kind of things. And that way you don't have to update it every time you add a new position.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we can work towards that.
That could be part of the employee handbook.
Exactly.
Could be a section in the employee handbook.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
We're stealing good ideas. Always
good.
A good way to go.
Okay.
Ms. Searcy, anything else?
No, I'm good.
That's the end of your questions? Ms. Menes?
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Moving along our agenda, next we have committee reports. We'll start with Ms. Searcy. None?
None.
Ms. Menes? None? Okay. I do have one to share with you. My time on the Economic Development Council, just a brief update. They've completed their rebranding audit, the county commissioners funded, along with the Chamber of Commerce, and what they've done is they've identified key industries which we will be pursuing. And if you go to their new website, they have a brand new website built. They gave me one printout, which I'll leave to you. Hopefully, I'm sure that Dr. Arnett and Dr. Rendell are working with them on making sure that we have feeder programs for all of these, whether it's distribution or things along those lines. We have a new logo, all sorts of new things. So they have invested heavily in this website to draw site selectors for different industries to our county in hopes of creating true economic development, which means our children and grandchildren can stay here and work here if they want to and have a good life. So that's essentially it for me, just the Economic Development Council.
Wonderful.
Anything else?
Did they have a picture of that that recycling plant down on
the Murph?
Enios.
No, sir. Oh, Enios. And if you're interested in a biofuels plant, there is one for sale here in Indian River County. Thankfully, I don't believe the county invested heavily in making that happen.
They gave them a lot of money.
Millions.
All right. Well, I stand corrected.
That's not heavy, though, compared to, you know,
right.
Billions, I guess.
Right.
They gave
well,
money.
Compared to what St. Lucie did with, like, the digital domain
yeah.
place and all those things. Well, economic development is a risky business, especially in that sector, the biofuel sector. But that's it. That's it for my committee reports. Dr. Rendell, you have some items?
Yes, I just have one. I've shared with each board member individually, but maybe not, the public may not be aware. We're making a shift kind of back to traditional grading at the elementary schools. This year, we were going to go to standards-based grading in all elementary grades. We've actually been in standards-based grading, so to speak, for KM1, kindergarten and first grade, for a couple of years now. And this year we were supposed to make the transition in grades 2, 3, 4, and 5. After much thought and deliberation, we decided to go back to traditional report cards for grades 2, 3, 4, and 5, traditional grading system, letters A, B, C, D, and F, percentage grades, and that kind of thing. The standards-based model has merit. If you're trying to make sure everybody masters standards, then the standards-based model makes sense. But mastering the standard is really level 3 on a 4-point scale, and we felt that wasn't giving everybody enough feedback on a student's real performance. If they were a 3, a 2, a 4, most of our community is not really aware of what that means, and some of our own employees are not really 100% certain what a 4, what the difference is between a 3 and a 4, and if your 3 is proficiency, how do you get to 4, and that kind of thing. So we made the decision to go back to a traditional elementary report card for grades 2, 3, 4, and 5. I want to thank Mr. Green and his staff, basically not quite overnight, but over a period of 2 days, they were able to convert what we had entered into focus on a 4-point scale back to traditional grading on a 100-point scale, so to speak, or an A, B, C, D, or F. And so teachers right now are reviewing those grades in focus to make sure what they had entered before we froze the grades are accurate, and we'll be opening that window later this week so that parents can then see the grades and make sure that they understand how their son or daughter is performing in those classes, and that way they'll be ready for next week. Next week is parent conferences, parent-teacher conferences, so we wanted to make sure that when we decided to make the change that we made it quickly or made it soon enough that we'd have it ready for parent conferences. It's one of those things that the standards-based model did look very good, and it has merit, but really for reporting back on how well students are doing in a frame, in a common language that everybody understands, it's made more sense to go back to traditional, at least for the time being. So that's what we're doing in grades 2, 3, 4, and 5 for the rest of the year and for the near future as far as we know.
Any questions?
I just wanted to compliment whoever brought that situation up. Because the question, when you presented it to us, at least over the telephone, you said, somebody asked the question, why are we doing this?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's an amazing statement to make, and I hope that all the administrators will do that, mm-hmm. you know, because a lot of times we're just doing it because, well, we've always done it, and that doesn't make sense, you know. So my compliments to whoever made that famous statement, why are we doing this?
Well, I'll give Ms. Tampier some of the credit for that, you know, because she's got a fresh set of eyes coming in from a different county. Curriculum is her background, and she's spent plenty of years at the K-8 building, and so she knows the elementary model. She knows what standards-based looks like, and she knows the challenge of going to true standards-based grading. So she was one of the people in the room that asked that question.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one quick question, because I'm sure we've all heard feedback from the public. Whenever we try to implement a program, there are the two sides, right? There's the policy and the politics. I just want to make sure that we're not sacrificing good policy to satisfy some pushback.
Sure, and I apologize for not giving you a complete picture of what the elementary report card is going to look like. It's going to have the letter grades A, B, C, D, or F, and the percentages in it. But then underneath those different subject areas, there will be places where the standards will be referenced. Mm-hmm. So there'll be... and Pam could probably explain this better than I can, but there'll be ways to measure how we're doing on those standards. So you'll be able to see not only what grades your son or daughter is getting, but how well they're progressing on the standards.
Great. So it's a hybridized report now.
Yes.
Somewhat.
Okay.
Yep.
Great.
And again, kudos to Mr. Green and his staff for figuring out how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, everyone.
That's going to be on the report card.
Yes, sir.
Progress report, too, right?
Yes. For those that are mastered or have not mastered, and then when you take the, when you see the report card the second quarter, if they mastered it, you won't see it, it will be blank. So it's easier for the parents to read.
Mm-hmm. But they'll be able to see some of that information actually in focus as well.
Just as long as they will understand what they're looking at.
It will say X means not mastered.
Okay.
And blank means has
good.
Been.
Thank you.
Good. Yes, ma'am, you have a question?
Is it possible for this next coming year for district to provide at each school, if it's site-based or not, for parents to be able to understand how to read the FSA report that comes back? If you look at that FSA little booklet, it has a lot of information on it. Parents will always need is... what level my child is, and they see the cut score, which they don't understand the cut score. And then they see all this other information about your child measured as, you know, along with state and local level. And it is a booklet that if you look at it, you would have to have a PhD degree because it's not a layman term. And I think that it does need to have, I don't know if they can go to the PTSA, I don't know how you can do it, but it does need to be a way to explain that booklet with that data on it because parents do not get it.
Thank you for that feedback.
It's a great idea. Actually, the state did send out some information on how to interpret the score report. I believe there might be a video associated with it. The challenge for us, and we'll meet the challenge, but the challenge for us is a lot of times we get that information over the summer. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a captive audience necessarily.
Right.
You know, but
orientation.
But yeah, it could be something that if we don't do it over the summer, we can do it as everybody comes back.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody comes at the beginning of the year to open
also,
house and everything.
A lot of parents, because I volunteer, a lot of parents don't even pick up the FSA report.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they don't even know where their child is. But they send it, they forward it to the next school if they are feeder pattern to middle school.
Right.
But at the same time, they're taking it home again, where? In the book bag.
Yeah, some of us may remember the days when we used to mail the FCAT report permit, but that was a budget cost, and so that was something that all districts got away with. So, but as far as explaining the SCORE report, that's a really good idea.
And thank you. And that's something that could be integrated as we see more Title I schools when they have the Title I parent meetings to integrate that. And I'd be careful with these videos. I went to one of the Title I school parent orientations, and they showed a video from the state. And sometimes people just need human, like a person there giving them the main points, because to sit and passively watch a video for 9 minutes, it is also just not best educational practice, especially for parents that may be struggling with the language that is being used. So maybe looking at how it is delivered, because a video may not do the work that is needed.
Understood.
Anything else, Dr. Rendell?
I'm good, thank you.
Board?
Yes, sir. When students move up from one grade to the next, and they have some exceptionalities or whatever, do we put that new teacher on notice before those students get there? And does their IEP, if they have one, go with that student in advance so the teacher can get prepared for her or his or her year?
I wouldn't say in advance. In other words, it doesn't happen at the end of the year. It happens at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
So, for example, a secondary teacher is going to get a list in their mailbox of all the students who have various learning disabilities or challenges, and so it's incumbent upon them, though, to look up the student's IEP to see what accommodations.
So it's their fault if they don't get the information. I mean, okay.
Yes, sir.
And just as a follow-up, I think I've brought this up before. I mean, I understand the complexity of the challenges we face in the school district, but one of the things that is concern to me relative to this question is that I don't know if there's any way that when the school year starts, the school district can address those IEPs, because these students are coming with an IEP from the previous year. And a lot of times it's not until 3 or 4 or 5 or more months into the school year that those IEPs are actually, that there's an IEP meeting. So, you know, by then, the teacher has already formed an impression of the student. The student continues with that frustration of his or her learning issue. So is there any way that the school district can look at the possibility within the complexities of the system of those IEPs actually being looked at in a more timely manner so that the student has the opportunity to get the services and support needed earlier on versus when they've already, you know, started the process? And I know that, you know, this isn't a blame thing, because when I have been to IEP meetings, I see the team, I see everyone working. So it's not that people are not doing their jobs. It's just that by the time all of this happens, there's some time that has been lost. And I don't know if it's even feasible.
Yeah,
you know?
It's basically a calendaring issue with as many IEPs that each school would have.
Mm-hmm.
Personnel involved, basically it's a year-long cycle. You're scheduling the IEP meetings throughout the year. And, you know, but there can always be some measures taken at the beginning of the year to make sure everybody is aware of what the students' learning disabilities are.
Well, I remember when I was teaching, that was one of the things that Dr. Jones would, I mean, she would hit us right away with, hey, have you pulled all your IEPs and you pulled your ESOL students and things like that. So I know that there's, you know, a site-based piece, but as far as when you say review, do you mean a full-blown IEP review, or do you mean
so
just
what
have
I'm getting
the teacher
at
have the information?
Is you may get the IEP, right? And those IEPs are very difficult to follow to begin with. But then when you look at the IEP, there are all of these strategies and all these recommendations for what you do for that student. So it would be helpful to know, this student had an IEP last year. These were all the strategies. What worked, what didn't? So that when you start working with that child, with that student, you have an idea from the beginning, okay, these are strategies that have been effective, these are strategies that are not, and this will sustain me until we have an actual formal meeting and meet with the team and figure out what's working or not. Because just knowing, I can get a list of, I have 25 students with IEPs. Great. What are my strategies? What has worked before? Because, you know, a lot of times you talk to the parents also and find out, you know, what are the strategies that work at home? But do you see what I'm saying? It's not enough to just give me a list and say, you have 50 of 100 of your students on IEPs. Like, okay, what works? How can I be supported as a teacher? Because that is going to set the tone for my school year. So,
and with our new model of providing support in the schools with our student support specialists and our resource specialists, we are looking with the laser-like focus and how we can continue to provide support. You know, we're looking at all of our ESE allocations and how can we meet the needs of all of our students. So that is something that we'll take in, make sure we take into consideration and come up with a plan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So is the trend more and more and more of our students are getting the IEPs?
I don't have any information to say that we have a large increase.
Okay.
If a student is coming from out of state or out of county, it does take a while to get their IEPs.
Yeah.
But if they're coming from within, we should be able to have that.
And I don't have any data to support that. All of a sudden, we're getting a large increase in the number of students with.
It seems like it's always a big subject. I mean, there's a lot of talk about it, but.
And one of the things with that, I think one of the reasons why there's a lot of talk is because there are students that fall through the cracks. And so what happens is we only see the students that get the IEPs, but I've been to school where sometimes you are made aware that there are issues. And when I ask, so what services is this student getting? I'm told, well, this student does not qualify for an IEP. So they have challenges. They have behavior issues. They don't qualify for an IEP. And the teachers now have a student in their classroom, aside from their IEP student, aside from the diversity of levels of ability in the classroom, aside from the behavior issues. And now they have a student that doesn't qualify but definitely need support, and there's no mechanism really in place to give them that support because they are like 1 point below or 2 points below or whatever. And so I think that's why that comes up, and that I guess for me that is a concern, because when we look at how that impacts learning, how it impacts behavior, and then those students get referrals, and then those students fall into that whole pipeline that, you know, some people talk about. It's a complexity. And, you know, there's, again, it's not a blame thing. It's like when we have the awareness, how can we try to fix it? How can we try to do something? And if we don't bring it up, it kind of gets lost. So
and to follow up on that, the other 18 children that are in the class, they're the ones that suffer whenever we've got that person just below and they're out of control, possibly, and the teacher's having to take care of that student and forgetting about 18 other students. So
and
I don't know the answer to that.
It's hard. And I did have a question.
Sure.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Around this topic, because I'm experiencing it with my daughter teaching third grade out in California. How do we, when we get new teachers, are we mindful in terms of their class composition to make sure that they don't get these classes that are, like, my daughter is teaching third grade, and she has one of the most, some of the veteran teachers have told her, you have one of the most difficult classrooms in our school. And I'm, you know, and I just thought, you know, I wonder how our school district does that, because, you know, I've seen with some schools we had 8 teachers, we have so many teachers that are leaving and so on. How do we do that? Are we mindful not to slam our brand new teachers that are all excited to teach and give them a little balance in their?
So there's no rule, but typically at the elementary level, what you're supposed to do is have a diverse classroom, you know, different levels. You're supposed to spread the wealth out, so to speak. You know, when you get to the secondary level, now you start to stratify a little bit because you've got honors classes, non-honors classes, and that kind of thing. The idea is to try to match up the teacher with the subject area in class that they're going to be the most successful with. Same thing with the students. Pam, anything to add?
Sometimes we do cluster our ESE and ESOL students so we can provide services, so that could make, you know, a difference. Or if that teacher, another teacher decides to leave, so then you're hiring, so then that person would be hired for that position. So sometimes we have to cluster those so we can provide services to those classes, especially at the elementary level.
Okay.
So thanks.
Sorry.
Would we be better off clustering all of the ESE students? together?
No, sir.
I mean, at a given school? I mean, we have these separate classrooms for some of the schools.
Well, we provide support facilitation where
and have extra teachers there, whatever you need?
We do, but usually at the elementary level, you have two or three teachers at, say, first grade that is going to be the ESE teacher or the ESOL teacher. It's usually three will do ESOL, three will do ESE, and then the services, the additional teachers are going into the classroom to provide that support. Otherwise, you'd have it spread across six classrooms, and you're really not going to, you know, it's not going to be as effective. You can't provide those services.
Okay. Yes, ma'am, you have a question?
No.
Or comment?
The school district that I came from, I worked in the elementary. They typically would do a fifth grade transition meeting. I don't necessarily think it was an official IEP meeting, but at that point in time, they, did a review so that things would be documented about that student prior to their moving up. Mm. So that the teacher would have current, within 3 months, information about that student. I think that they felt that on the other grades, when there was a move up within that school, that the teacher would be able to find out from other providers that had been helping the student as they went along as to what things would be good for them to know. But there was an official meeting set up for every fifth grader who had an IEP before they moved to the middle school.
Wow. And they do the same thing for eighth grade as well, going into high school. And we do that?
Yes.
That's our practice?
Yes.
Going from eighth grade
to
ninth school. To sixth
and
eighth.
To fifth to sixth.
Oh, okay. Fifth is grade bands or education bands. I would also assume that some of the focus information that was presented to us recently using the focus software would be, now that we're getting our IEPs all digitized and things like that. So the information sharing within focus as to what, as Menz was saying, as to what works and what hasn't worked, some of that knowledge would be captured, codified, and shared with future teachers using the focus.
Yeah, much more easily accessible. Back in the day, so to speak, you had to go find the student's CUM folder, right? Mm-hmm. The actual physical folder, and see if there were notes from the previous year's teacher and that kind of thing. And in fact, in elementary, usually you see back then the teachers would do a really, really good job of writing notes at the end of the year for the next year's teacher because, they're trying to take care of it, all the kids. Mm-hmm. Now that's all electronic. All those notes will be in focus and everything like that. So even if a kid moves into your classroom halfway through the year, you'll be able to access all that data. You don't have to go pull the file. Great. You can look at it at 2 o'clock in the morning at your house.
Good, good.
And at what point does that new teacher get access to her all the students she's going to he or she's going to have this coming year? Does she get that at the end of the year, or
not usually? I don't know that we assign any classes, build the rosters like that till over the summer.
Would it be beneficial to do that?
In an ideal world, that would be fantastic.
No, but I mean ours. Yeah. I'm not talking about
ideal. I honestly don't know that we would be able to do that in the spring,
and
at
why
the end
not?
Of the year.
And why not?
Because you haven't made all your hiring decisions. You haven't made all your master schedule decisions. You haven't, even at the elementary level, you still haven't built classes. You got to wait till you get all your numbers. And,
And the FSA data, all of that data,
true.
We use that to make decisions.
Right,
as far
based
as
on student performance.
So what you do with all that data, you try to make each one of the classes homogenized, so you've got the high and the low. And
except for in those instances like Ms. Dampier was talking about, where you have students with special needs, you might cluster them so you have the teacher that has that certification or that background or that skill. So
that's the goal.
Ms. Mintz.
And I think it might be worthwhile at a future workshop or even now, to talk about the idea of, because what we're talking about, if we were to do that, is tracking. And
right.
There's a lot of history around tracking and the positives and negatives of doing that. And so that needs to be part of that conversation, because that helps inform this need for not homogeneity but diversity in a classroom, which obviously has tremendous implications for the teacher who has to deal with the various levels of it. So that might be something to consider talking about in the future.
Didn't the tracking just start at one of our elementary schools in North County? I don't think they call it tracking, but I want to call it leveling. Mm-hmm. Didn't that happen at one of the elementary schools?
You might be talking about RTI, response to intervention. So during the school day at the elementary school, there's a period of time where the kids are ability grouped for additional instruction, response to intervention. So that is totally based on their performance level.
And that's usually 30 minutes a day.
Yeah.
Okay. And which school? That's it? One of the
North schools? All of our schools do that.
Oh, is it all of them?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I thought there was one of the gentlemen, a new principal at one of the North County elementary schools that implemented something like that, and we saw it on the video or something.
Well, you're talking about Chris Colstead, probably at Pelican Island Elementary.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he was talking about leveled instruction and probably RTI. I don't think he has his classes or ability-based like that, like a full, you know.
And then we also want to make sure that those kids who are above level are being enriched. So during that RTI time, we're looking at providing support for all of our students below, on grade level and above.
Mm-hmm. You have a question or comment?
Yeah, a question. What was the reason for them to remove all the ESD students from Stone Grove to Sebastian?
It wasn't all the ESD students. I believe it was one self-contained unit, and we didn't have enough of those students remaining at Storm Grove to warrant the unit, so we combined it with the unit at Sebastian River Middle.
Okay.
I believe that's the class you're talking about.
And then I have talked to some of those teachers that are teaching those students at their strength, because they don't have any teacher assistants. They have autistic kids that are in these classes, and they have no teacher assistants.
Pam's writing it down right now. She'll check into it. You know, that's the ASD unit, so we'll check.
Yeah.
And
as a follow-up, I think it might be interesting for the board to get a sense of, throughout the school district, how many self-contained ESD units do we have, what are the criteria for these self-contained units, and what are the staffing patterns for the self-contained units, because when we look at budget, we want to make sure that they're adequately staffed and that they have adequately trained ESD aides, because one of the problems we face is that sometimes the training is not adequate and the aides themselves cause more problems to the lead teacher than support. And, you know, and that's an ongoing area of growing edge for the school district, but I think the board needs to be aware, because that's where you as a board, we as a board, can be advocates when we're looking at positions and when we look on the personnel list and we see that ESD positions are being cut. You know, we track it, make sure that they're replaced and that teachers are getting the ESD support they need, because these self-contained classes can be very challenging. And, you know, and what are the numbers? Do we have, you know, because I know years ago I visited one of the classes that was just the math for ESD, and that was at the time when we were being, you know, people were complaining about our student stations. And so this particular math class in one of our middle schools had maybe 8 students and had one instructor and I believe at least one aide. And even then, when I sat through that class, the one aide was helping one student that had specific needs, and the teacher was working with 7 other students. And even though the number ratio was so low, the work that that poor teacher could accomplish with 7 students with such severe needs was it was just very challenging. And I think sometimes those things need to be, the board needs to be aware, because when we look at this and the community looks at this, they're like, what do you mean 8 kids and 1 teacher and 2 aides? That's a waste of money. But when you see the context and you see the challenge, then you can say, well, this needs to be budgeted because this is what the students need. And if we don't have that information, we make these judgments based on cut, 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 cut. And that's what I'm talking about. That's what I was referring to earlier. And it behooves us as board members to be informed, because that way we can support what's being done and understand the value of some of these positions.
Sounds like a great topic for a future workshop.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anything else?
The only way to get that information and address it is at meetings like this, where
yep.
we appeal to the folks that are in charge of that, because we don't normally go to all the classrooms and visit them like that. So.
Yep. Okay. But similar, you know, you guys asked several months ago for a report on Title I, so we had a workshop and we shared all the different Title I, ins and outs of Title I, where the money comes from, what it's used for. So we'll do something with the ESD.
Yeah. And just one final thing. You know, we don't obviously have time to go to all the classrooms, but I do think, you know, as we look at the work that we do at school board, as school board members, I think the schools appreciate seeing their elected mm-hmm. school board members visiting the schools. I don't think that we are a hindrance to the principals if we let them know and tell them, you know, I don't need to be here all day. I don't need a dog and pony show. Right. I just want to visit. And if you are concerned about what's happening in ESC or something else, you can talk to them. Can I visit an ESC classroom? You know, can I visit this? They're more than willing. And if they're not, they should be, because that is part of our job. Not that we're going to be doing this all the time, but I think sometimes when board members think, because when I got on the board, I was always chastised for doing that, and I felt, you know what, that's part of my job. If I'm not in the schools visiting once in a while, I only get one side of the issue. And how can I make an informed vote? So, you know, moving forward, I understand that everybody has a million other things going on, but this is something that once in a while a visit is greatly appreciated, and the teachers also appreciate seeing their board members in the school. So, you know, something to keep in mind, not that you're going to do it all the time, but, you know, once in a while, it really is encouraging and uplifting to the schools.
And in fact, there was legislation that passed last session that allowed and actually requires, if you read the language, it requires the board members to visit school sites. Now, it passed that a board has to visit, which is, to my mind, silly. That's some fine-tuning for next session. But because some superintendents and principals weren't as open to having school board members visit and make suggestions for improvement within the district, that they aren't as fortunate as we are here mm-hmm. in Indian River County. So that is an opportunity, and Ms. Menes is right. That's mm-hmm. something that we can't take for granted as school board members, that we have that opportunity.
Right, but one more thing, though. You know, the caution with this is it's not saying that you're going to go to a school and tell a principal what to
right.
do
yes.
or tell a teacher what to do right. or say, if you have a problem, call me. No. It means that you're going to allow the chain of command. If there's a problem, you follow the chain of command, because the only person that I can tell, ooh, I'm concerned about this, is Dr. Rendell. And then he talks to the principal, because when I got on the board, that was one of the problems. That chain of command was being circumvented, and it was polarizing the superintendent and the board, because people were going to board members saying, Mr. Searcy, fix that. Mr. Frost, fix that. Mr. Searcy can't fix anything. Mr. Frost can't fix anything, because we are a collective, no matter how much we think we can, you know, we wish we could. It's board corporate. So Mr. Searcy may have an idea, Mr. Frost, whoever, they may have an idea, but it's the board corporate that does that. And you know, so, because I think that sometimes when people say that, it's like, oh yeah, they're going to go in and I'm going to go tell that principal. That is not our job. And correct. If we sense that we are being triangulated in that sense, we need to talk to our superintendent. Otherwise, we go back to the dysfunction that I walked into 8 years ago when that wasn't being done. And that doesn't serve anyone. It doesn't serve the students. It doesn't serve the district. And while it may be nice for our egos to think that we have that kind of clout, people, we don't. So, you know, I think it's important, because it could be misconstrued, and I'm not saying to go into classrooms or schools and tell principals how to do their job. That is not what I'm saying.
No, but to your point, actually, that would, you know, Mr. Searcy having the opportunity to lay eyes on a self-contained cluster, I think is to great benefit to everyone.
Absolutely.
So, you know, obviously, he's not there to tell them how to do their job, but for his understanding.
No, I know. I'm saying in the past.
No, I understand.
I encountered that. We encountered that.
That's, yes. It's understood. Anything else?
I'm done, man.
No? No further business before the board. We stand adjourned.
So 4 o'clock is our next?
Yep. 4 o'clock up the shade.
All right.
4 o'clock in the shade.
Thank you.
All right. I don't really like these.